And yet a Palestinian American cannot share that stage to also make that call. It feels hypocritical to us. The DNC's platform says they don't value Israeli lives or Palestinian lives over one another. And yet by not having a Palestinian American be able to speak from that stage and address this crowd, you're showing that you do. You're showing that you have a hierarchy of who's valued and whose life matters and whose doesn't. And so that's one of those low demands. Ultimately, our primary demand is for policy change. It's for an arms embargo, because we believe that that's the only strategy that's going to successfully create a ceasefire, a permanent ceasefire. And so we're there on the floor. We're making those calls. It was significant, and I've talked to some of my fellow uncommitted delegates. It was significant, my dad's statement to folks. They really felt like he's standing in solidarity with us, which, again, was the whole purpose, right, was to come here and say, not tell Harris delegates that they shouldn't support who they want to support, but to say, stand with us, sign our ceasefire letter, call for an arms embargo. You can support your candidate, but stand with us in holding your candidate accountable. If we could have gotten those things, our hope was that we could walk in uncommitted, but with seeing some of those demands met, walk out committed, walk out excited to go knock doors and make phone calls and say, hey, this is the candidate that's going to end a genocide. We haven't seen that yet.
We want to thank you both for being with us. We're going to continue this discussion. Minneapolis City Council member Jeremiah Ellison and Branko Marcetic, staff writer at Jacobin. We will link to your articles on walls and covering the conventions. That does it for this show. We are broadcasting for 2 hours every day from the Chicago Convention. Go to democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh here in Chicago.
You're tuned in to listener-supported community radio.
The leaves are falling, the birds are chirping, and KBOO's fall membership drive is back. If you enjoy alternative radio that pushes the status quo, then support KBOO by becoming a member today. Donate online at kboo.fm/give between now and September 21st and support independent airwaves.
Support for KBOO comes from KBOO members and the International Travel Group. KBOO Community Radio and ITG are organizing a journey to Cuba, December 14th to the 21st. It is a guided exchange of music, history, and landscapes. ITG supports KBOO's mission of fostering community through diverse voices. More information at kboo.fm/Cuba.
The Democratic National Convention in Chicago. This is Democracy Now! War, peace, and the presidency. Breaking with convention.
It's the honor of my life to accept your nomination for Vice President of the United States.
As Minnesota Governor Tim Walz spoke at the Democratic National Convention, a group of uncommitted delegates began a sit-in just outside the convention hall after the Democratic National Committee denied their request for a Palestinian American to speak on stage. We'll hear from Minnesota Congressmember Ilhan Omar, who visited the sit-in. Then we'll talk to Dr. Tanya Hashassin, a pediatric intensive care surgeon who volunteered in Gaza and is now here in Chicago. The DNC also rejected calls for her to address the convention.
We have treated so many children who have lost their entire family that a term has been coined to describe these children. You've probably heard it, Wounded Child, No Surviving Family, WCNSF. This is a term that has been coined since October to describe this very frequent phenomenon that I personally witnessed more times than I can count while I was there.
Plus, we'll look at the climate crisis, an issue that's received little attention here at the DNC. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, War, Peace, and the Presidency, Breaking with Convention. I'm Amy Goodman. Minnesota Governor Tim Walz accepted the Democratic nomination for vice president Wednesday on the third night of the Democratic National Convention here in Chicago. Walz played up his time as a former high school football coach and outlined his achievements as governor.
We made sure that every kid in our state gets breakfast and lunch every day. So while other states were banning books from their schools, we were banishing hunger from ours.
Among the other speakers last night were the parents of Hirsch Goldberg Polan, an American-Israeli hostage being held by Hamas in Gaza. This is his dad, John Polan.
In an inflamed Middle East, we know the one thing that can most immediately release pressure and bring calm to the entire region, a deal that brings this diverse group of 109 hostages home and ends the suffering of the innocent civilians in Gaza.
Outside the United Center, the convention hall, delegates from the Uncommitted Movement and their supporters launched a sit-in Wednesday night after the DNC and the Harris campaign refused to let a Palestinian American take the main stage, despite allowing the father and mother of an American-Israeli hostage address the convention. This is Georgia State Representative Ruah Raman.
Today, I watched my party say our tent can fit anti-choice Republicans, but it can't fit an elected official like me. I do not understand. I do not understand why being a Palestinian has become disqualifying in this country.
In response to the Democrats' refusal to allow a Palestinian American to address the Democratic National Convention, the group Muslim Women for Harris Walz announced it was disbanding, saying in a statement, quote, "This is a terrible message to send to Democrats. Palestinians have the right to speak about Palestine," unquote. Protesters also took to the streets of Chicago Wednesday for more rallies calling for an end to U.S. support for Israel's war on Gaza. In Gaza, Israeli attacks continue to kill more Palestinians, with at least 22 reported deaths today. On Wednesday, at least 13 people were killed, including children, in an attack east of Khan Yunis. This is a father who lost his teenage son.
Oh, my son, Moody is dead. Moody is dead. They hit us and we're all destroyed. He was so precious to me, my oldest son, my darling son.
How old was he?
14 years old. He hasn't seen anything in his life. I went to buy him a rooster and left it on the floor. A mere 10 minutes later, we were hit. God rest your soul.
Another Israeli strike on a school acting as a shelter in Gaza City killed two people and injured 10 children. Meanwhile, new report from Defense for Children International Palestine says Israeli forces are detaining and torturing Palestinian children in Gaza, using children as human shields and, quote, intentionally and systematically separating children from their families. The report includes testimony of child survivors, including the stories of boys who were forced to strip naked and walk with their hands bound in front of Israeli tanks and bulldozers. They say they were also beaten, denied water, and threatened with dogs. 16-year-old Abdulmunim was abducted with his younger brother, Ali. He said he was barely able to move after Israeli forces blindfolded them, tied them up, and beat them with rifles before leaving them in the cold. On Wednesday, U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken headed home after his latest visit to the region once again failed to secure a Gaza ceasefire. Blinken warned the failed plan may have been the chance to avert a broader regional war. A British diplomat has resigned, charging the UK government with complicity in war crimes amidst its continued military aid and arms supply to Israel. Mark Smith previously worked in Middle East arms export licensing assessment for the British government and said he raised his concerns, including to Foreign Secretary David Lammy, but was ignored. He recently spoke to the BBC.
For me personally, my profession or former profession as of last week was to advise the government on the legality of arms sales. And when you look at what constitutes a war crime, it's actually quite clear, even from what you see in open source on the TV, that the state of Israel is perpetrating war crimes in plain sight.
The Biden administration in March approved a revised nuclear strategy that for the first time shifted its focus on China's supposed nuclear threat in addition to Russia and North Korea. The secret policy was revealed by the New York Times this week. Anti-nuclear advocates have called on the U.S. to stop ratcheting up nuclear tensions and its nuclear arsenal. In Afghanistan, the Taliban has barred UN Special Rapporteur on Human Rights Richard Bennett from entering the country. Bennett has previously called the Taliban's treatment of women and girls a likely crime against humanity. Since regaining power 3 years ago, the Taliban has largely barred women and girls from education and much of the workforce, and aid agencies have reported an increase in child and forced marriage, gender-based violence, and femicides with impunity. In New Caledonia, UN experts have found France guilty of undermining the rights of indigenous Kanak people and its plan to expand voter rolls. Earlier this year, a French bill that would allow foreign residents who've been living in New Caledonia for 10 years to vote set off a series of deadly protests. New Caledonia has been under French control since its colonization by France in the 19th century. But some 40% of the population is Kanak. A growing independence movement is seeking an end to colonial rule. Back in the United States, in Oregon, the ACLU is suing the city of Medford, saying its police have been illegally spying on progressive political activists and groups for several years. The lawsuit accuses the Medford Police Department of monitoring the social media accounts of activists and groups involved in racial justice, LGBTQ plus rights, reproductive justice, housing justice, harm reduction, and decriminalization, and collecting information on them. The groups and activists in question were not suspected of involvement in any criminal activity. In more election news, Kamala Harris has raised nearly $500 million over the past month since President Biden dropped out of the race. Democrats expect the total to hit $600 million by the end of the month. This comes as campaign reform advocates have called out both the Democrats and the Republicans for failing to disclose the source of some of their largest contributions using a practice known as bundling. Bundlers collect large sums of money, but candidates are not required to disclose their information. The nonprofit group Issue One said disclosure is, quote, a transparency practice that is a guardrail for good government, and to see both sides eroding that guardrail is concerning, they said. And the Texas Court of Criminal Appeals will review the case of Crystal Mason, a black mother who was sentenced to 5 years in prison for attempting to cast a provisional ballot in the 2016 election when she was ineligible to vote. At the time, Mason was on supervised release for a tax felony and was unaware that this barred her from casting a ballot. Her ballot was never actually counted. Mason's conviction was already overturned, and she was acquitted earlier this year, but Tarrant County conservative district attorney appealed the decision. Crystal Mason appeared on Democracy Now! In 2018. Crystal, do you ever plan to vote again?
I do, and that's what I'm encouraging my kids to get out there so we can make a difference right now. I do. I just feel right now that the system failed me. You get out, you rehabilitate yourself, you get a good job, you go to school, you graduate from school, you're doing everything right. So why would I go and vote to go back to prison?
Yeah, but I mean, she could sit And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, War, Peace, and the Presidency, Breaking with Convention. Coming up, we hear from Minnesota Congresswoman Ilhan Omar. She visited a sit-in of uncommitted Democratic delegates outside the Democratic National Convention last night after party officials rejected a request for a Palestinian American to be invited to speak on stage. And we'll go live to the sit-in for the latest. Stay with us. Survival by Earth, Wind, and Fire. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. War, Peace, and the Presidency, Breaking with Convention. We're broadcasting from the studios of CAN Public Access TV here in Chicago. I'm Amy Goodman.
And I'm Nermeen Sheikh. Welcome to our listeners and viewers across the country and around the world. Delegates from the Uncommitted Movement and their allies launched a sit-in protest Wednesday night after the DNC refused to let a Palestinian American take the main stage, despite allowing the parents of an American Israeli hostage to address the convention. Uncommitted delegates were selected in state Democratic primaries earlier this year to call for an end to the Biden administration's backing of Israel in its assault on Gaza. The sit-in continued throughout the night and is still ongoing at the time of this broadcast. Among those who addressed the crowd last night at the sit-in was Rua Rahman, a Palestinian-American who is a Georgia state representative and an uncommitted delegate. She was among the list of speakers offered by the uncommitted movement that the DNC refused to allow on stage. This is some of what she had to say last night.
Good evening, everybody. My name is Rua Rahman. I am a Georgia state representative. I'm an elected Democrat. I come from the swing state of Georgia. We are not here to create any divisions. As my colleagues have said over and over and over again, the only reason we are here, the only reason we are here is to ensure that Donald Trump will never make it to the White House and save the lives of the people that we love. It's about the fact that today I watched my party say our tent can fit anti-choice Republicans, but it can't fit an elected official like me? I do not understand. I do not understand why being a Palestinian has become disqualifying in this country. I don't know how much more we have to prove. All of us have decade or more long resumes working for this party because we know that this party is the only one that's ever tried to meet the promise of our country. We are here to literally save the soul of our party. I do not understand why that is a bad thing. This would have truly and sincerely been a beautiful gesture to show this party cares about the cries of an Israeli child the same way they care about the cries of a Palestinian child. We are not asking for too much. All we wanted was to be on that stage and show people desperate for hope. There is something to hope for.
That was Georgia State Representative, Uncommitted Delegate Rua Rahman. Among those who came to the sit-in to express their support were Pennsylvania Congresswoman Summer Lee and Minnesota Congresswoman Ilhan Omar. I caught up with Congressmember Omar at the sit-in last night.
The uncommitted delegates who are here asking for a Palestinian speaker on the stage of the DNC. Do you support this?
Yes, I did put in a request for that accommodation to be made, both to the Harris campaign and to our the chairman of the DNC. I am hopeful that that they will hear. It's not just me who made that request. There's multiple leaders within the Democratic Party who are here have also made that request.
And the delegates here who have sat down asking for this one response say they've been simply told no.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's heartbreaking to learn. That hasn't been the response. The response was to me, be patient, we'll figure out something. It's unfortunate that if they have been told no.
Do you think there's still a chance for them to change their minds?
Every phone call I've had, every conversation I've had today has been be patient with us. We'll figure something out.
So. Do you think Vice President Harris takes a different position than President Biden on the issue of an arms embargo, on the issue of stopping supporting Israel's assault on Gaza?
She has certainly been more forceful talking about how this war and its devastation is unconscionable. I do hope that tomorrow we get to hear what her policy positions will be going forward.
You spoke earlier today. Can you talk about your message?
My message is this is not about just winning votes. It's about living up to the words that we say about caring for our neighbors, for having a heart, for being compassionate. If that is who we are as Democrats, there is no compassion in continuing to fund this genocidal war. There is no compassion in turning our heads away from the piles of dead bodies that have been going on for the last 10 years. There is no compassion and care in simply keeping this the status quo. There is compassion and care in saying we know that a ceasefire is only possible if we use every leverage that we have, and the biggest leverage that we have is to stop sending bombs. Thank you all.
That's Minnesota Congresswoman Ilhan Omar. She visited the sit-in where we are going right now, just outside the United Center, the convention center. We're joined by Asma Mohammed, campaign manager for Vote Uncommitted Minnesota and co-chair of the Minnesota Uncommitted Delegation, one of the 11 Minnesota Uncommitted Delegates at the DNC. She spent the entire night at the sit-in, though wasn't planning to do that, and we were having her on to talk about Governor Walz. She is from Minneapolis, but right now in this sit-in that looked like it surprised all of you last night when you got word that your request for a Palestinian-American speaker had been denied. Can you describe what you understand is happening? I understand that Roger Lau, the executive director of the Democratic National Committee, stayed with you all overnight, concerned that he wanted to make sure you weren't arrested, but you haven't had your demands met. Explain why you're sitting there, Asma. I know the video might be a little dodgy here, but we thought it was really important to hear your voice from the sit-in site.
Yeah, and I'll have a boss share in a moment as well. But it was important to sit here because the demand hasn't been met. We set the lowest bar for our party. And we've gotten questions like, why now? Why is now the time? Because this is our party. I've spent over a decade of my life organizing for Democrats up and down the ballot professionally. It is within my right as a Democrat to ask for a Palestinian. I'm not a Palestinian myself, but I'm advocating for a Palestinian like Ruwa Rahman, like Abdel Nasser Rashid, like the brilliant Palestinian elected leaders and representatives that we have to be able to have a chance to speak to what has been happening in Gaza over the past 10 months to be able to speak to what they're feeling right now as Palestinian Americans. And to have that denied reminded me, it made me feel that this tent, this party, isn't big enough. And I think for those who are watching, the messages that I've been getting from people in my community is, do we have a place in this party right now? And as a Democrat, I never want to send that message to my people. I never want my people to feel like they don't have a place in this party. I'm going to give it to Abbas.
Well, sitting alongside you, Asma, we see Abbas Alaweya, who has also been there overnight. Abbas, if you could talk about how this night has passed and what kind of response you're expecting now from the DNC.
Thank you so much. It's great to be on with you. As uncommitted delegates, Asma and I are 30 uncommitted delegates who came to the convention supporting a ceasefire that stops the bombs and that reunites all captives, all Israeli and Palestinian captives, with their families. We came here as 30 uncommitted delegates. We've been organizing as we're here. A whole bunch of Harris delegates have joined us. We're almost 300 what we're calling ceasefire delegates. The position that we're representing is widely popular among Democrats. We need to stop sending weapons that kill civilians. That's how we achieve a ceasefire. Those are the demands of our movement. As we are continuing to push those demands, we had a secondary ask that we thought, we think our demands are very reasonable. Stop killing people we love. But we had a secondary ask that we thought for sure was a slam dunk in the party of representation, in the party where everybody gets to at least be heard. We thought that in the party that allowed for an Uber executive to speak from the main stage, Uber, a company that treats its workers terribly, I might add, in this party, at least they would allow for a Palestinian American to speak from the stage in this moment when our own government has contributed so profoundly, unfortunately, horrifically, to the pain that Palestinians and Palestinian Americans are experiencing. And so overnight, we were thinking about our central demand. We need our government to stop sending weapons. We also, honestly, are in a state of shock. This level of silencing, this level of exclusion, this does not belong in our Democratic Party. And we know that the majority of Democratic voters across the country agree with us. We are appalled that Democratic Party leadership have given us an answer of no. We hope that will not be their final answer. We're still sitting out here right in front of the United Center. I have my phone. I'm waiting for the Democratic Party to call back and tell us, hopefully, that this is not a party that silences Palestinians and those advocating for Palestinians.
When we heard you were having the sit-in and we raced over to the United Center, you all seemed as surprised as anyone to be having this, as you got what you thought at the time was the final no, though nothing is final. But you do have the executive director of the DNC right there, of the Democratic National Committee, Asma Muhammad. Is that right, Roger Lau? And can you ask him these questions? I mean, he stayed with you all overnight.
Yeah, so we've been in touch with a whole bunch of folks, both at the DNC and on Vice President Harris's team. So it's not just one individual. We know that everybody in Democratic leadership has been aware of this request. So the issue isn't with any one individual. The issue is with, unfortunately, a systematic problem in our party, a systematic problem in our country, where there are pro-war forces. There are pro-war forces in our country. They're not the majority. We're the majority, and we're going to win. We will end the war. That's what the American people want. But there are pro-war forces that make money off of every additional bomb that drops and kills babies. That is the difficult thing that we're sitting in. And for some reason, after a very long back and forth with the DNC, where we were feeding them names, and we were having a member of Congress after member of Congress also get in touch with the vice president's team and folks pushing from the inside, after all of that, and after we felt we were very close, out of nowhere, the answer is no. Someone vetoed it. I don't know who they are. They probably oppose Palestinian human rights, but we are people who support all human rights. We support human rights for all people, including Palestinians, and we are the majority in this country.
86% of Democrats support a ceasefire. I know the people at this convention want to hear from a Palestinian. They need to hear from a Palestinian. As someone who isn't Palestinian, I want to hear from a Palestinian on that main stage. They deserve that stage. They need that stage. Do you not think that over the last 10 months that we at least owe Palestinian Americans that? I do.
Asma, we originally booked you before this sit-in. You were going to be in the studio. You are an uncommitted delegate from Minnesota. And we wanted to ask you, and we'll end with this question, what is your governor, Minnesota Governor Tim Walz, who was speaking inside the convention center where you planned to be last night as you all sat down outside, what is his position around the uncommitted the uncommitted delegates and around Gaza?
Around uncommitted voters, he's been actually very kind. After we 46,000 voters joined us to say that we want an end to the genocide, he said those people need to be heard. And right now, he has an opportunity to tell his running mates to hear us. He has an opportunity to say, we need to let them take the main stage. He has an opportunity to say, we need to stop sending bombs. So if he feels like we need to be heard, like he said on March 6th, the day after the primary election in Minnesota, then he needs to make that very clear in this moment. Because as Minnesotans, we always, always reference late Senator Paul Wellstone. We say we all do better when we all do better. Well, I think that includes Palestinians too.
Asma Mohammed, we want to thank you so much for being with us, an uncommitted delegate from Minnesota, and Abbas Alawea, an uncommitted delegate from Michigan. They are both taking part in a sit-in. We're speaking to them where they are, just outside the United Center, just outside the Democratic National Convention.
And we're joined now by Dr. Tania Haj Hassan, a pediatric intensive care surgeon who volunteered in Gaza many times. Earlier this week, she spoke at the first ever panel on Palestinian human rights held at a Democratic convention. Uncommitted delegates had asked the DNC to allow Dr. Tania Haj Hassan to speak on the main stage, but she's not been invited. Dr. Tania, welcome back to the show. So if you could just begin by saying, if you'd been given the opportunity to speak on the main stage of the Democratic National Convention, what would you have said?
So I think, you know, I'm an American citizen. Every American physician and surgeon that I know that's been to Gaza and returned comes back with the same very urgent message. And in fact, when I was first contacted about potentially coming and speaking, I rang the other American doctors and surgeons that I know to see if any of them would be available to join me here in Chicago. And I got an overwhelming response of yes from everybody, with the exception of one person who couldn't swap out of their shifts. And so that tells you how much we all feel like we need to deliver this message. You cannot unsee what you witnessed there. It is so horrific, so egregious. And we know that it's being funded by American bombs, and it's being enabled by American bombs. And indirect contrast to demonstrated realities on the ground, documented realities on the ground, universal condemnation from international human rights and humanitarian organizations, and findings by the ICJ of plausible genocide. And so I would have liked to get up on the stage and say, look, for the last 10 months, we've witnessed massacre after massacre, massacres of schools where internally displaced people were sheltering, massacres outside of hospitals, massacres of flower massacre, water distribution site massacres, humanitarian distribution site massacres. And we have witnessed as our healthcare worker colleagues have been detained, tortured, killed. We have witnessed as healthcare workers, healthcare workers, journalists, humanitarian workers have been killed at an unprecedented and in record-breaking numbers. We feel very much, particularly when we know that international journalists are not let inside of Gaza for the last 10 months, we feel like our witness becomes particularly important. You know, I work for an organization called Médecins Sans Frontières, Doctors Without Borders, and one of our core principles is témoignage, the concept of bearing witness. And that was an organization founded by journalists and doctors with the understanding that when atrocities are committed anywhere in the world, it's very important that we bear witness to those atrocities. And that's particularly important as a physician when you're trained not only to treat disease, but to prevent disease and illness. And there's a very easy way, well within the grasp of the American government, to prevent this disease. But instead, we are enabling it.
Dr. Tanya, you're a pediatric intensive care physician. So can you tell us the story of a child in Gaza that stays with you even as you have left?
I mean, it's hard, Amy. There are so many stories. It's really heartbreaking. Every single day I would sit down and try and find 5 minutes alone to kind of reflect on what happened throughout my day. And this is a practice I've always had in medicine. You know, when a patient of mine dies, I take a minute. Sometimes I go to the bathroom, sometimes I do it in the patient's room, just to kind of honor that person. There was no time. There was no time. You know, I remember trying to resuscitate two children at the same time, along with my Palestinian colleagues on a bed, and there were no family members around for either child. They were cousins, and one of their families, their entire family of one of them was killed. Maybe even fortunately for him, he ended up dying too. And the other one, both of her parents were severely injured in the same attack and so weren't at her bedside. And it's really heartbreaking. I shared the story the day before yesterday of a child who'd lost his parents and all of his siblings, bar one sister, who was burned beyond recognition, and in the bed next to him while we were treating him. And he kept calling her name because he didn't recognize that this body in the bed next to him, burned beyond recognition, was his sister. She died about 2 days later in the intensive care unit, and he survived with horrible injuries, but will function well. However, I don't know how he would ever psychologically survive from that. He told me the following day that he wished he had died. He said, "Everybody I love is in heaven. I don't want to be here anymore." And this is the daily reality. This was in March. My colleague, a pain doctor in Gaza, who's trying to practice pain relief for patients right now as we speak without adequate access to pain medications, told me 2 days ago that children around him are wishing for death. And Amy, just importantly for what's happening right now outside the DNC, I'm not Palestinian. I know there are a lot of rumors going around that I am Palestinian. I'm not. And in fact, it would be an honor to be a Palestinian, particularly today as I watch my Palestinian colleagues come in day after day after day to the hospital, dedicating every ounce of their being to their patients, despite having been displaced 5 times, having had their own family members killed, knowing that they're a clear target of this military campaign, with over 500 of them killed, some executed, and many detained and tortured. I am not a Palestinian, but I think the fact that people are trying to discredit me by calling me a Palestinian is very telling of how we view the Palestinian voice. You know, Palestinians are humans, are wonderful human beings, and this constant effort to dehumanize is so destructive, not only to the Palestinians themselves, but for the perpetrators of this dehumanization. When you dehumanize others, you dehumanize yourself. And I'm really sad to see that the DNC is part of this process of dehumanization, of not giving Palestinians a voice where they deserve it. And I don't want to be speaking on that platform. I want one of my Palestinian colleagues, and certainly one of the Palestinian delegates would be. But if you're looking for a medical voice, I would have wanted one of my Palestinians in Gaza to be on that platform. people like Dr. Hammam Alo, who you interviewed, who said he was not going to leave his patients. He said, if I leave my patients, who will treat them? So he didn't evacuate and was killed. Or people like Dr. Mahmoud, Doctors Without Borders physician, who stayed at Al Auda Hospital and wrote on a board, whoever stays will tell our story, remember us. He was killed. That sign that he wrote was destroyed. This is the reality for healthcare workers in Gaza right now, and they are the ones who should be speaking right now, not me.
Very quickly. First case of polio, 10-month-old infant in Gaza. The crisis of a disease that was eradicated decades ago there. And how it affects children and the demand for all the children of Gaza to be inoculated.
Amy, the resurgence of polio is a symptom. It's a symptom of the bigger disease. And it's very concerning. It's a deadly disease. It causes paralysis. Particularly deadly is the paralysis of the breathing muscles that would require you to be on a ventilator. If that were to happen, there aren't enough ventilators. There aren't enough intensive care beds. The majority of the hospitals in Gaza have been destroyed. There are a remaining few partially functioning hospitals. So it would be a death sentence for many people who contract the disease, not to mention the public health disaster of the resurgence of a eradicated, very contagious disease. But it is a symptom of these unlivable conditions that have been architectured by this military campaign. Destruction of sewage systems, destruction of clean water supply, people living in overcrowded conditions, over 1,000 people sharing a bathroom or a shower. These are the sort of conditions that are not compatible with life and that are very compatible with the resurgence of these sorts of eradicated diseases. We were already seeing measles, hepatitis, other communicable diseases that you see when people are in crowded circumstances like they are in Gaza right now.
Well, we want to thank you for being with us and for people to hear Dr. Tanya Hajhassan's testimony before the first ever Palestinian Human Rights Panel held by the Democratic National Convention. It was a side event of the convention itself. You can go to democracynow.org. Dr. Hajhassan is a pediatric intensive care physician, served many times in Gaza hospitals, co-founder of the social media account Gaza Medic Voices, which shares firsthand accounts from healthcare professionals in Gaza. Coming up, we host a roundtable on an issue that's received very little attention here at the DNC, the climate crisis. We'll be back in a minute. Everything is Everything by Sinkane. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, War, Peace, and the Presidency, Breaking with Convention. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh. We're broadcasting from the studios of CAN TV here in Chicago.
We turn now to look at the climate crisis. On Wednesday, climate activists disrupted an event by Punch Bowl News on the sidelines of the DNC that was sponsored by ExxonMobil. This is California DNC member R.L. Miller.
I'm a Democratic committee, National Committee member. I am here because Exxon lied and people died.
So far this week, the climate crisis has barely been mentioned from the stage at the Democratic National Convention. To look more at the climate crisis, we're joined by three guests. Michael Mann is with us, climate scientist, professor, University of Pennsylvania. His new article is headlined Project 2025, the right-wing conspiracy to torpedo global climate action. His most recent book is titled Our Fragile Moment, How Lessons from Earth's Past Can Help Us Survive the Climate Crisis. Colin Reese is with us here in studio in Chicago, political director of Oil Change U.S. This week, they published their updated report titled Behind the Barrel, New Insights into the Countries and Companies Behind Israel's Fuel Supply. And Tara Hauske joins us. She's an indigenous lawyer, activist, and founder of the Ginu Collective. She is Ojibwe, brutally arrested in 2021 for participating in a nonviolent action in Minnesota against Line 3. Tara, we're going to begin with you. You're joining us from the White Earth Reservation in Minnesota. Tim Walz is the governor of Minnesota. And I'm wondering if you can talk about his record and your activism in Minnesota and how the state has responded.
I am still carrying the scars of Tim Walz's environmental legacy in Minnesota, which is one that saw the largest tar sands infrastructure project in North America built, which Line 3 you mentioned, and basically unfolded a series of, I think, band-aids, climate band-aids of, you know, we're going to electrify some the grid, we're going to try to do some solar panels, we'll do some investments into renewables, but simultaneously approve massive mega projects that, you know, the harms of those 50 new coal-fired plants, irrevocable harm to future generations and to our drinking water, and specifically in Minnesota, calling you from the White Earth Reservation, there were very serious concerns by multiple tribal nations about wild rice and the water quality that would be impacted by Line 3, which it now is. We're looking at what happens after these folks' climate policies are put into place.
And what's his relationship, Tara, in general to fossil fuels and your sense of his overall climate policy?
It seems to me to be a policy that is carried throughout Democratic values currently these days, which is we will say that we stand for climate change. We will say that we stand for science. We will say that we are going to engage in policy to move us forward and make progress while simultaneously allowing in massive pushes against those exact policies and progress. You're approving massive tar sands infrastructure projects while you're, you know, electrifying our buses or something like that. Or you're saying we stand for human rights and for human values while simultaneously allowing a genocide, a crime against humanity to occur. That seems to be the stance of Democrats these days, including Tim Walz.
And can you talk about, you're an indigenous lawyer, activist, environmentalist. Talk about your arrest, why Line 3 is so significant, and the promises made by Governor Walz when it came to the indigenous community and informing you about developments and including you in decision-making around environmental issues.
Governor Walz picked Peggy Flanagan, who is a member of White Earth Nation, as his running mate. She was firmly against Line 3. She came to our protests, engaged in all the demonstrations against the project years before its construction. And Tim Walz himself, when he was in office, said, you know, line three is a non-starter. Any pipeline through treaty territory without consent is a non-starter, and yet allowed the process to continue of approving this project through our wild rice beds, through over 800 wetlands, through over 200 rivers, including the headwaters of the Mississippi River. I mean, it was basically, I'm going to stand back and say, let the process play out, and I don't want to interfere with checks and balances. But that seems to be the same attitudes we're seeing from the current vice president, right? Of, I'm going to stand back. I don't really have any power here. I mean, you're sitting in some of the most powerful office of influence in the state, in the country, and saying you don't have power. That is absolutely insane when such serious, serious matters sit in front of us. I personally engaged because this was about my treaty territories, the people, my people's treaty territories. This is about wild rice, about the continuation of our culture and who we are as people, and faced serious brutality over a dozen charges, criminal charges. I was put into solitary confinement. I was shot with pepper balls and mace and tear gas and all that stuff. I mean, the same things we saw play out in Standing Rock.
Now, you just mentioned Peggy Flanagan. Very significant that if Governor Walz becomes vice president, she assumes the governorship. She would be the first indigenous woman governor in the country. Can you talk about what that would mean?
I look at it like this. I think that we are seeing history, right, when these powerful folks step into leadership. I also see that there seems to be a growing sense of, if we put in the specific identity into this seat, that means that we've done our jobs. Secretary Deb Haaland was the first Native woman to sit in the Secretary of the Interior position, yet in the first 2 years, they approved more oil and gas leases than the Trump administration. That is not in line with what the hope is, right? The hope in making progress like that. The hope is, you put someone in those positions who understands the community, who comes from that community, who knows the issues faced, and will be a voice for change, who will push and force those changes to happen, not just maintain the status quo and not be a face for allowing these harms to occur that have lasting impacts to future generations.
So, Colin Reese, if you could talk about the significance of the Punch Bowl news event sponsored by ExxonMobil, what we introduced earlier in the segment, which occurred just outside the DNC that you and other climate activists disrupted. What was that event about, and why did you decide to take this collective action then?
Thanks, Dream. I think the Punch Bowl news event sponsored by Exxon yesterday was essentially another symptom of what Tara has just mentioned, of a Democratic Party that is not actually serious about ending fossil fuels. There have been some cracks of light, some cracks in the facade in the direction of eliminating fossil fuels or constraining fossil fuel production, but vastly far from what is needed. And so I think when you have an event on the sidelines of the DNC, sponsored by Exxon, with members of Congress showing up and proudly speaking next to them, with clean power lobbyists showing up there, it shows me you're not serious about climate change. This is a company that is not only not meeting its climate targets, not a part of the solution in terms of the climate crisis, it's also actively working to elect Republicans. It is donating vastly more to the Republican Party than to Democrats. They have no place at the Democratic National Convention, and I think we've seen that. As I mentioned, we put out a report earlier this summer called Big Oil Reality Check, juxtaposing the rhetoric and climate commitments on paper of these massive oil companies like Exxon. Exxon scored among the absolute worst. They failed across the board for continuing massive oil and gas expansion, massive human rights violations, despite this rhetoric. So this is not a serious company that should be involved in the energy transition in any way. They do not deserve a platform here, and we wanted to show up and make that clear.
Now, your response in general to how little the climate crisis has so far been mentioned at the DNC, which you would think for the Democrats it's like a key issue, but it hasn't really been focused on at all.
You would think. I think it has been a disquieting lack of discussion around the climate crisis. And I think in part that's because it is increasingly clear that in order to adequately address the climate crisis, we need to be bold. We need to confront these fossil fuel actors. I think the irony to me is that these are massively popular political positions. People don't like big oil and gas. People don't like Exxon and Chevron destroying their water and polluting their communities and jacking up the price of gas. This is not something that the American people actually want. And so I think it just goes to show still how deep big oil and gas have their tendrils within the Democratic Party and within key constituencies. Even in the state of Pennsylvania, a majority of residents support banning fracking. These are not radical positions, and in fact, I think Vice President Harris would find it's something that's really critical to young voters in particular and voters on the front lines of both climate impacts and fossil fuel exploitation and extraction, indigenous communities everywhere else. These are voters who are still very concerned about the Biden-Harris administration's record on fossil fuels, to put it very mildly, also about the genocide in Gaza, and they need to see more action.
I wanted to bring Professor Michael Mann into this conversation, climate scientist, professor at University of Pennsylvania. I wanted to get your comment on that, how little it's been addressed, but your focus really has been Project 2025 that has alarmed so many in this country. Your article headline, Project 2025, the right-wing conspiracy to torpedo global climate action. Professor Mann.
Yeah, thanks, Amy. It's good to talk with you. And I appreciate the comments of the other two panelists here, but I'm going to provide a slightly different perspective. Because the real threat here is not the Democratic Party, it's the Republican Party and this agenda, Project 2025, which will obliterate climate action as we know it. It will get rid of essentially all of the climate-related entities within the Environmental Protection Agency. It will axe NOAA, the National Oceanographic and Atmospheric Administration, because Republicans don't even want us measuring the changes in climate. It will revoke the Inflation Reduction Act, which is the single most successful and important piece of climate legislation that has ever been signed into law, and which will achieve roughly 40% reduction in carbon emissions by 2030 if it's fully implemented. And so, yes, that doesn't get us far enough. We need a 50% reduction by 2050, and we need to bring those carbon emissions down to zero by mid-century. But it puts us on the right path. And so it's really night and day when it comes to the climate issue. Yes, the Democratic Party, as we've heard, hasn't been perfect here. Part of the problem has been that when President Biden, for example, tried to block new fossil fuel infrastructure on public lands and prevent new drilling, what he encountered a court system, a Supreme Court that has now been filled with conservative justices who are lackeys for the fossil fuel industry. And so right now, it's very difficult to get any executive actions on climate past this very conservative Supreme Court. The only way we can change that, of course, is by voting in enough pro-climate politicians, Democrats, not Republicans, who are willing to institute changes in the Supreme Court itself, possibly expanding the court, because they are doing so much damage right now. They're preventing the executive branch from taking any action on climate. What we need is legislation, executive action, and we need a Supreme Court that can't block all of that. And the only way we're going to do that is by turning out en masse and voting for climate-forward candidates in this next election. It's really, the choice couldn't be more stark. It's really a question of whether or not we will see any meaningful action on climate in the years ahead.
Well, what would you like to hear Kamala Harris say about climate tonight when she addresses the DNC?
Yeah, thanks. I'd like to hear her talk a little bit more about it. We've heard references to the climate crisis. In fact, it's been singled out as one of the great challenges we face by a number of speakers. It hasn't been the central focus. And part of what I think is going on here, at least this is in my view, there is no path to climate action that doesn't go through a functioning American democracy. If the U.S. doesn't take leadership here, the rest of the world won't either. And so there's been a lot of focus on the threats to democracy, the threat to democracy by the Republican Party, because without American democracy, there can be no action on all of the things we care about. I would like to, hear Kamala make that connection in her speech tonight, to connect the dots that climate change, the climate crisis, is impacting our ability to solve any of the great challenges that we face today, and that there will be no action on climate if we allow Republicans control the White House or either House of Congress.
I want to put this question to Colin Reese. That new report by Oil Change International lays out the countries and companies that have transferred the most fossil fuels to Israel since it launched its war in Gaza, says they could be liable for complicity in war crimes. Explain.
That's right. So our new report, Behind the Barrel, released in collaboration with Datadesk earlier this week, shows that the countries and companies around the world are continuing to ship oil to Israel, continuing to support the Israeli state, even while they are perpetuating this genocide against the Palestinian people. And two-thirds of that oil, two-thirds of the oil being shipped to Israel is being shipped by, is oil coming from private and investor-owned companies, such as Exxon, Chevron, BP, as we've mentioned. These are the arsonists of global warming, but also driving war and conflict around the world. And I think it's important for the countries and companies noted in this report in our update to recognize their liability as well. We've heard from others on this program and beyond about the ICJ's, the International Court of Justice's, ruling of a plausible genocide that's occurring. That opens up significant liability for these companies and countries, and we wanted to get this data out there, make it clear that things have not changed in the last few months, despite that ruling from the ICJ and despite incredible resistance from around the world.
I'm going to give the last word to Tara Housko. What do you want to hear Kamala Harris say as she accepts the presidential nomination tonight from the Democratic Party? We have just like 30 seconds.
I want to hear Kamala Harris say the words that she is actually open to an arms embargo to actually stop the genocide in Gaza from unfolding. Saying ceasefire over and over again as the goalposts continue to shift just isn't enough. I want her to say that she is going to directly and unequivocally address the climate crisis with actions, not just words.
Tara Housko, we want to thank you for being with us, Indigenous lawyer, activist, founder of the Ginu Collective, speaking to us from the White Earth Reservation in Minnesota. Colin Reese of Oil Change US will link to your report. And Michael Mann, climate scientist and professor at the University of Pennsylvania. We will also link to your article on Project 2025. That does it for our show. We've expanded to 2 hours every day here at the Democratic Convention. Check out our shows at democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman with Ermin Sheikh from Chicago.